Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
On this episode of Most Notorious, J. Frank Norris, controversial Christian fundamentalist and accused 1920s murderer.
And Norris went out to where this guy was, went out to the scene, and he found in the car a half-broken bottle of liquor. And he brought that. It actually had brain tissue in the bottle. And he brought that back to the church the next Sunday and put it on the pulpit and preached a message from that passage in Daniel with the handwriting on the wall, "Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting." So, that was the kind of graphic stuff that he did that some people loved and other people found just had no place, you know, in church.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Most Notorious. I'm Eric Rivenis. So before we get started, I have been thinking about redoing / replacing or deleting the first 12 episodes of Most Notorious. Why? Because I use that silly gangster voice, which I thought would be entertaining. It was certainly entertaining for me. And I didn't think too much of it at the time because I didn't think that many people would listen to it. But things changed. And when I listen to them now, I don't like them. Not the interviews, not my guests, of course, but me and the way I talk. So I don't know yet how I will do this. I'll probably start by asking the original authors if they don't mind redoing them. If the author is unavailable, I may just delete the episode completely and do another interview on the same subject with a different author. So again, I'm not 100% sure how this will proceed, but it will take place over the next few months. And if you want to re-listen to those episodes again, for whatever reason, you may want to do it now because there is no telling when they might disappear. Oh, except on Patreon. They will live forever for patrons on patreon.com/mostnotorious. Anyway, let's get on with the show. My guest today is David Stokes. He is a Wall Street Journal best-selling author, ordained minister, commentator, broadcaster, and columnist, and an author. Some of his titles include Camelot's Cousin, The Spy Who Betrayed Kennedy, Jack and Dick, When Kennedy Met Nixon, and Jake and Clara, Scandal, Politics, Hollywood, and Murder. And if you recognize that last book title, it might be because he was a guest on the show back in July of 2017. The book he is here to talk about today is called Apparent Danger, The Pastor of America's First Megachurch, and the Texas murder trial of the decade in the 1920s. Great to have you.
Great to be with you, Eric.
So when and where did you first hear about this story?
As a kid, it so happens that the pastor that was in question, and the story takes place in Texas, also had an affiliation with a church in the 30s and the 40s in Detroit, Michigan. And that happened to be the church where my grandparents and my mother, when she was a little girl, attended some. And so that was the connection there. And I heard about this story about this minister, this preacher, who killed a guy, faced the death penalty. And so I started reading about it in college and then started gathering materials. I guess I spent about 20 years gathering materials for this book and finally pursued it in earnest, I guess about 12 years ago, and just released an updated version here recently.
Very cool. So if you don't mind, let's start with J. Frank Norris. Who was he? Where was he born? What were some of the childhood experiences that helped shape him?
Yeah, he was born in Alabama, but at a young age, he and his family moved to Texas, to the hill country of Texas. And a little place called Hubbard City is where they lived. And he had an alcoholic father, what was called back then a drunkard. They didn't use the term alcoholic. This is in the late 19th century going into the 20th century. And a very devout mother who was the strongest by far influence on his life. One of his defining moments was when he was a teenager. His father, because of his struggle with alcohol, was always in trouble. And some people showed up to collect some money off of him. And there was a fight and gunfire happened. And it just so happened that a stray bullet hit a young John Franklin or J. Frank Norris. And he nearly died. It became sort of a defining moment as he was nursed back to health by his mother. And soon set his eyes on something that had been her dream for him, and that is to be a preacher, to be a minister.
Did he have a come to Jesus moment as a boy?
Yeah, he did. He had a conversion moment, a revival in his church in Hubbard City, and he really became sort of a protege of a local pastor who eventually sent him and helped him find the money to go to Baylor University in Waco. Baylor, of course, was begun as a Baptist training ground for ministers. It is so much more now, even national champs, I guess, in basketball or near that. But they were, back at that time, around the turn of the 20th century, 1900, 1901, it was a training ground for most Baptist ministers, particularly the Southern Baptist Convention at the time.
Tell us about the Baptist Church, if you could, at the turn of the 20th century, and how it compares to the Baptist Church of today.
Well, that's interesting. There were a lot of struggles going on. Of course, some of the big things in the later part of the 19th century were the rise of theological changes in Baptist life, and also, for instance, the rise of evolutionary thought. So people were moving away from creationism. It became a big struggle. So there was that divide among Baptists between the more liberal elements and the more conservative elements. Just like you see now among major denominations, the issues may be different, but the dynamics in many senses are the same. And Norris was part of the conservative group. Eventually, they became known as fundamentalist. It was a word that really came to be around World War I, but the idea of being a fundamentalist, not only in mindset, but there were certain fundamentals they believed that you had to believe and you had to be dogmatic about in order to be an authentic Christian, and certainly a Baptist, an authentic Baptist. And so he was pretty strict in his thinking, and very authoritarian in his approach as he even trained. You know, when he was at Baylor, he even helped get the president of Baylor University fired. They had smuggled a dog into chapel service, and the dog was yelping. And the president became so mad, he threw the dog out the window, but it was the second floor, and the dog died. And Norris led a student revolt that eventually the trustees of the college fired the president. Norris early on developed a desire to be a rabble-rouser. He loved to create controversy and be in the center of it. And that followed him for the rest of his life until he died in 1952.
You write in your book that as a theology student, he did have a bit of a cruel streak.
Yeah, he did, which some people may think, well, that's an odd thing because you're supposed to be a Christian. But he did. He had a cruel streak, a mean streak. You know, as I studied about him, and of course I have a background in the ministry too, you wonder if this guy was a bad man who did a few good things, or if he was a good man who did some bad things. And I think it's really hard to figure out. I've described him before as a cross between Billy Sunday, we might say Billy Graham now, that'd be a name more familiar, and P.T. Barnum, with a little Al Capone thrown in. And that sort of gives you an idea of what this preacher, this minister was like.
Yeah. So I am a big fan of my fellow native Minnesotan author Sinclair Lewis, who wrote one of my favorite books, which has a connection to this story, Elmer Gantry.
Yeah, Elmer Gantry, actually, when Lewis was researching that book, he made a special trip to Fort Worth, Texas, where Norris was the pastor of the First Baptist Church. This is in the middle 1920s. And Lewis attended a service at First Baptist, and he told the newspaper, a local paper, that he'd never before seen as many people at church at one time as he did that day. And he talked about Norris's energy. And so Norris became one of the prototypes, one of the models he studied for the character that he created in his novel, Elmer Gantry, and also that became in the movie with Burt Lancaster some years later. So there was a connection between Norris and Sinclair Lewis.
So he gets married and becomes the son-in-law of a pretty wealthy man, right? Right.
Yes, exactly, yes. He marries and the son-in-law of a wealthy person who's also very much involved in the Southern Baptist Convention. So it's a real ladder climb for Norris. And the father-in-law dies under mysterious circumstances. He falls off the back of a train. And the only other person witness to it was his son-in-law. And there were already rumors at the time that he may have pushed him because the son-in-law inherited a great deal of money. Now, this is after he's done with college and he's beginning his ministerial career. And the money enabled him to buy the controlling shares of a major periodical, a newspaper at the time called the Texas Baptist Standard, which was published up until the last few years. And it was a major periodical, and he became the editor of it, and he used it to make a name for himself. But the money that he used to buy those shares came from money that he inherited. It's never been proven at all, you know, whether he was involved or whether it was just a tragic accident for his father-in-law to die on the back of a train. But in later years, after some other scandals came out, including Norris shooting a person, which is the focus of the book, many people wanted to revisit that. And I think it's been revisited a little bit now in a book that's forthcoming by a former pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, a man by the name of O.S. Hawkins. But I haven't seen that book yet, so I'll look forward to reading that.
So it's around this point that as the editor of the Baptist Standard, he starts to insert himself into local politics, right?
Yeah, he does. A big thing in Texas at the time was racetrack gambling. And of course, you know, gambling, it was, you know, very popular today, but it was always regarded as a vice. And certainly more conservative clergymen preached against it. So he took the lead of a movement. There were two things that were happening. And they were, interestingly, they were known as progressive causes. And one is prohibition, and the other is, to a lesser extent, this gambling law in Texas. But he led the fight got racetrack gambling banned in the state of Texas for decades. It didn't come back until the 1940s or so. And so he got a taste for the public fight, the big dispute, what later the moral majority and some of the other crusading groups of Christian people, the so-called Christian right, he was really doing that decades before. He was the the ancestor and the father of most of that in this country.
So how does he get the job as pastor of Fort Wayne's First Baptist Church?
Well, he wound up giving up ownership of the Baptist Standard, was sort of pressured out, and he didn't know exactly what to do. And he was invited to speak at First Baptist Church in downtown Fort Worth, Texas, which at the time was known as the Church of the Cattle Kings. It was had more millionaires in the congregation than any church in the country. And they liked what they heard, and they invited him back and back. And finally, they called him as their pastor. And he immediately became high profile. The two First Baptists, the one in Dallas, Texas, and the one in Fort Worth, were the giant churches in the Southern Baptist Convention. And he built First Baptist in Fort Worth into a mega church of thousands upon thousands of people before that term was coined. But he also became, interestingly enough, the highest paid minister in the country when he became pastor of the First Baptist Church in Fort Worth. So it was a very prestigious pulpit. A lot of the wealthy, powerful people in and around the city of the Fort Worth were members of the church, but that didn't last very long.
So you write in your book that in the first couple of years as pastor of this church, he gave pretty standard sermons. But then he came to a very deliberate decision to start giving what you call sensationalized sermons. What are sensationalized sermons, and why did he decide to do that?
He became what could be best described as a ministerial populist. In other words, he was conservative in his theology, but that wasn't nearly as important as reaching the masses and drawing a crowd. And so he would use any means. He coined a phrase, the message doesn't change, but the methods do. And he used all sorts of methods to draw crowds to his church. I mean, he one time put a big sign up. This is around 1911, 1912. Put a big sign up in town, you know, the 10 biggest devils in Fort Worth, you know, names given this Sunday night, First Baptist Church, hear J. Frank Norris. Another time, he put, what prominent banker in Fort Worth is buying silk stockings for another man's wife? Hear J. Frank Norris, Sunday night. And he would somehow leverage those odd titles and those unusual subjects into a mainstream message, eventually, an old fire and brimstone kind of message. And he became very popular with an element of the culture that was not wealthy. It was the other side of the tracks. And of course, this caused all sorts of difficulties for him with the power structure of the church. And so instead of bowing to them, he basically fought them and ran them out. And his church at one time, I mean, when he went there, less than 1,000 people, and he lost about 600 people in the course of a few months. And most ministers wouldn't have been able to survive that. But then he leveraged that to start bringing in all sorts of all sorts of people from Hell's Half Acre, which was the seedy part of Fort Worth, very famous in that era, prostitution and gambling and alcohol and so forth. And he had that kind of ministry, I guess if you could call it, reaching the down and outers, and he reached them with great effectiveness and by the thousands.
He did do some really P.T. Barnumy type things. Didn't he, among other things, fill a giant tub with rattlesnakes one Sunday?
Yeah, rattlesnakes. One time he did apples, and he brought in a thing of apples, and he talked about Christy Matheson, who was a great pitcher at the time, and he started flinging apples out to the people in the crowd. Yeah, he did all kinds of things. One time a cowboy got converted and wanted to be baptized, but he wanted his horse to go with him. So Norris had the horse in the baptistry along with the cowboy. That kind of stuff. I mean, very sensational. He did it on purpose. He did it he was an opportunist. He was a populist. Was he doing it from good motives or not? I mean, he probably did help a lot of people. There were a lot of people who got off alcohol and quit destroying their lives, and you know, families were saved and reunited and so forth, but at what price, I guess some would suggest and ask.
Right. So when did he start developing ties to the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, the Ku Klux Klan sort of grew in America in the aftermath of the Great War, World War One, what we know as, and it was an anti-immigrant kind of thing. It was also something that was hard set against cultural change, and so in the early 20s, it became very popular, and it was anti-immigrant, anti-Jewish, certainly anti-Black African-American. But it was also anti-Catholic, and that was one of the strongest draws to Norris. Norris believed that Catholicism was the great menace in the country. He was paranoid about that. And you got to remember, it was till 1928 when we had a Catholic who ran for the presidency, Al Smith, and you know, the rumors were floating around that if he had been elected, the Pope was going to be living in the White House and all this. There was a lot of paranoia in this country. But the Klan, he became very involved with it. He even let the Klan hold meetings in his church auditorium. And he very, very chummy with them. And hired people on his staff. The Grand Dragon at one point in the mid-20s of the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan was on Norris's payroll at the church, one of the associate pastors of the church. And so that's a very sordid period of time in the country. But the Klan was, and fundamentalism, American fundamentalism, a lot of people who consider themselves conservative Christians don't like to think about this, but there was a real connection back then, at least. It was eventually, I think, repudiated, although I'm not so sure as effectively as it should have been. But there was a tremendous connection between fundamentalism and the Ku Klux Klan. They, in fact, the Klan people recruited heavily out of fundamentalist ranks, and it wouldn't be unusual for a church, especially in the South or some places in the North, places like Michigan, Indiana, where there was a strong anti-immigrant feeling, would have a great percentage of the men, particularly in the pews, who were also members of the Ku Klux Klan.
And we will return momentarily.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake, and if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Back again. So while serving as pastor of the First Baptist Church, he suddenly has to deal with a series of fires, both to the church and to his own personal residence.
Right. Yeah, he's involved in fights with the city. He's involved with arguments with the mayor of the town. And of course, he's trying to close down Hell's Half Acre, you know, the booze places and the gambling dens, and that he's the crusading kind of parson. And in doing this, he obviously makes some enemies. And his church, there were a couple of fires, but one of them larger than the other destroyed the old Gothic First Baptist Church. But there were some people who felt that the fires were suspicious. Were they set by Norris's enemies, or was something else at play? And so powerful was that feeling in the town that J. Frank Norris was indicted for arson and for perjury, for lying about it under oath before the grand jury, and was brought to a very, very famous trial. In fact, there were a series of trials. He was acquitted on all points. That just helped increase his legend among the common folk, you know, who saw him as a folk hero. But he was indicted for perjury and arson, and there are many people that believed he burned his own buildings down. And I got to tell you, I've gone through the evidence, I've gone through the court records, I've gone through all of it. I think there's a pretty good case to be made that Norris burned his own church down in order to create sympathy for himself.
Oh, I was going to ask you what the motive would have been, like to collect the insurance money or to clear the way for a bigger church, but it was to build sympathy.
Well, and also to build a bigger church. When he took First Baptist Church, it had been built by a famous pastor who predated him, and there was a big portrait of this guy that hung in the baptistry, and Norris hated it. You know, he felt it took away from him. He was a strong egotist. And so he was able to, once the building burned, build a new building and design it the way he wanted it to be, and certainly bigger and better. And he did so. And so that those are usually the motives ascribed to him, and also to make a name for himself.
So who were his enemies during this time?
Well, there definitely the people who were the liquor interest, for instance. This is pre-Prohibition. And remember, Prohibition became the law of the land in 1920, so there was a big movement, and it was controversial. But the liquor interest, the underworld, as it was in Fort Worth and in surrounding areas, I mean, this guy was a troublemaker to them. He wanted to close them down, and so it's not unusual for them to push back and to do things and to threaten to do things. And I certainly think there was an element of that. He had a lot of enemies of people who he had run out of his church. Some of the wealthy, remember, he lost a lot of the wealthy and powerful people, society's upper crust, when he started bringing in, you know, the people from the other side of the tracks. And they didn't go quietly. And many of those people became his long, long extended enemies. And so there were a number of factors at play there.
So he was bringing into his congregation people who were less affluent, as you just stated. That must have hit his pocketbook. Who was paying his salary, and how was he generating money?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I mean, he did have some wealthy friends who stayed with him. But, I mean, the way he just ran his church was, instead of having it, you know, controlled by a small group of people who were wealthy and powerful, you know, rather than get a lot of money from a few people, get a little money from a lot of people. He always struggled with money throughout his career, but always seemed to find what he needed. He was certainly a bit of a huckster. He was someone who could charm people, and you know, not unlike the televangelists that you would see today and in yesteryear. You know, people would, you know, gladly give him money and support him. And sometimes some of the poor elements are much more prone to do that than some of the wealthy people.
So when the 1920s roll around, prohibition is something that is just basically handed to him on a silver platter.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was tailor-made for him, and he exploited it. And by that time, he had established another paper, what he'd learned being at the Baptist Standard, his own paper called The Searchlight. And The Searchlight dealt with prohibition stuff and published his sermons and just all sorts of sensational things. And so, but yeah, he was, and he would preach sermons. One famous one, there was somebody powerful in town who was out to get him, and he would preach against, Norris preached against this guy, and this guy was out someplace outside Fort Worth, and he was in a terrible automobile accident, and he was there with a woman, not his wife. And Norris went out to where this guy was, went out to the scene, and he found in the car a half-broken bottle of liquor. And he brought that. It actually had brain tissue in the bottle. And he brought that back to the church the next Sunday and put it on the pulpit and preached a message from that passage in Daniel with the handwriting on the wall, "Thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting." So, that was the kind of graphic stuff that he did that some people loved and other people found just had no place, in church.
So not only did he have this massive congregation, this newspaper, The Searchlight, but he also took advantage of a brand new means of communication, the radio, correct?
Yeah, he was one of the pioneers of Christian broadcasting. Long lost now, people won't even find him in a footnote of the history, but he owned his own radio station that broadcasted out of First Baptist Church. And all of his sermons, in fact, his sermons were broadcast live until he died in 1952. And so, yeah, that was tailor-made for him, and he was effective. Eventually, he had a radio network that covered most of the southwest of the United States, Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas and New Mexico and Louisiana. And he became a star, a media star such as it was. And this was in the day and age before radio was regulated. There was no federal communication corporation, no FCC, until Hoover was the president, and Hoover was elected in 1928. So that didn't happen. So there were no rules about what could be said, what couldn't be said. It was a wild, wild west thing on the radio all the time, and he didn't fear being sued or whatever. He went after, and he used his radio station, as he did famously in the story of its symptoms of the book, to call out by name people in town and criticize his enemies, and those who were against him, and those he felt like didn't have the country's best interest or the town's best interest. And that gave him a megaphone, quite honestly, more than a paper which had to be subscribed to. This thing just went for free across the airwaves, across the country.
So throughout his career in Fort Worth, he had constant battles with people in political power, from his time at the Baptist Standard into the 1920s. And he did not mind sharing his feelings about the role of pastors in politics, or at least his role in politics.
He was really one of the first American ministers who used the power of his pulpit and his influence to endorse candidates, which he did regularly beginning in the early 20s. And he'd have them in to speak, and he'd endorse them. Of course, they were candidates who reflected his particular philosophy. And he would also use his powers to resist. And one of the people that he resisted was a person who was the mayor of Fort Worth in the mid-20s, H.C. Meacham, who owned a large department store in Fort Worth. One of the airports in Fort Worth is named for him to this day, Meacham Field. And Meacham was a person who criticized Norris, and Norris criticized him, and the city hired a city manager who looked into the tax laws and noticed that the First Baptist Church in Fort Worth not only had a church building, but they owned most of the other blocks around it. They were very prosperous. And then they'd lease their buildings out to local businesses, the local J.C. Penney's, for instance, in Fort Worth in the mid-1920s, was in a building, and they leased it from First Baptist Church. Problem was, because they were tax-exempt, they weren't paying taxes. Now, today, it's commonplace for churches that own properties and lease them for non-religious purposes pay taxes on that money. It's a given. But back then, it didn't happen, and they sent Norris a tax bill, and all hell broke loose. He declared war on City Hall, and it went to, into a full firestorm before it was over.
Meacham must have been furious that Norris was leasing his buildings to a competing department store.
Yeah, and there was that factor too. And so that played into it. And so Norris dug up some dirt about Meacham, and he published it all. Meacham had had an affair with one of his employees, and this is just unseemly stuff. But Norris broadcast it all over the radio, said he's not fit to be mayor of a hog pen, you know, and this is all going out to the public. And so Meacham and some of his close friends, at there was a famous, it's still there in Fort Worth, I've been to it, the Fort Worth Club, which was a private city club for all the movers and shakers in town. A group of men there, including Amon Carter, who later helped to just grow Fort Worth exponentially, they decided to they had to do something about this preacher, try to get rid of him, try to run him out of town, try to silence him, and of course that just Norris just doubled down when that happened.
So there is this absolutely fascinating scene in your book where Meacham, who has a heart condition and is not the most confrontational person in the world, he's sort of hiding in his office, and he gets word that there are newspaper boys hawking the searchlight in his store.
Yeah. So he said he asked his store manager, get those boys out of there. And then he overreacted. He played something right into Norris's hands. He asked his store manager if any of his employees of the store were members of Norris's church, and they found half a dozen, nine, I think, and they fired them all. Or they called him in and said, either you leave that church or you leave your job, which, can you imagine someone doing that today? It may be unconstitutional. But they wound up firing these employees simply because they were members of Norris's church and wouldn't repudiate their church and their pastor. Well, Norris seized the moment. He brought them on the platform the next Sunday and interviewed them and held a trial of sorts and published it in his newspaper. And that just, it didn't reflect well on the mayor. He shouldn't have taken that bait, but it continued to escalate things. This is in the summer of 1926. This is in the month of July in 1926. And Norris, by this time, is the largest religious leader in the country. William Jennings Bryan had died a year before. He was a contemporary of Norris, by the way, and a friend of Norris, had spoken at Norris's church. And Bryan died right after the Scopes trial in Tennessee. He was the leading fundamentalist. Norris decided he was going to be the heir of all things fundamentalist to William Jennings Bryan. And he was doing that around the country, traveling around and then dealing with this local problem in Fort Worth where the mayor was against him and firing his employees. And it was a hot summer and things were about to heat up even more when it came to local politics in Fort Worth in July of 1926.
Right. And Norris made a big deal over the fact that Meacham's manager, who was Catholic, had fired these Baptist members of the church.
Yep. And he just, he exploited it. And, you know, he brought them up to the platform, the Meacham Six, you know, and interviewed them. And, of course, this just fed, it just increased his popularity with the populist element, the element that need a hero. You know, I don't know, I don't want to go too political on this, but his people now, back then, would have been the kind of people storming the Capitol on January 6th. And in many ways, I saw so many parallels between Donald Trump and some of his personality quirks and a guy like Norris. Similar kind of thing. And a very strong ego and a very, very strong populist movement. And, you know, that is attractive to a certain element of the population.
So a man named Dexter Chips enters the scene. He was a friend and colleague of Mayor Meacham.
Right. He was a lumberman. He was somewhat wealthy. He was a member of the Fort Worth Club. He was a friend of Meacham. And he was someone who would do anything to help his friend and decided that he would take it into his own hands to confront Norris himself and get him to just stop talking about the mayor and just to back off. And so he paid a visit on him on a Saturday in July of 1926. First he called up, said he was coming over, and he paid a visit on him, and they argued in the office. And what happened next has been shrouded in controversy, and it's always part of a court record. But he left, he turned to leave, and before he got out the door, whether he turned to come back or not, that was never proven, but Norris reached into the desk, pulled out what he called the night watchman's gun, and fired several shots, and D.E. Chips, Dexter Elliott Chips, the lumberman, fell to the floor and eventually died there in the office after an argument with J. Frank Norris about his Sunday sermons. His mind, can you imagine, Eric, what would happen if a if Joel Osteen, of course he'd never do it, he's not that kind of person, but if Joel Osteen shot and killed a man, how big a news item that would be. Yeah. In America. I mean, my goodness. And it was, as the in radio and New York Times front page, I mean, it was a big story in 1926, but that's what happened. And then came arrest and indictment and eventually trial.
Yeah, I mean, there has always been such a fascination for us as Americans with clergymen who sin, right?
Yeah.
They're supposed to be held to higher standards.
Well, and they should be. I mean, and we should be. And that's, there's not, it's not appropriate. It's not inappropriate to say that at all. And people also, there's something about hypocrisy, you know. Norris was never popular after that. And he was still popular with his own element. But any hope he had about being, I mean, there were thoughts that he might run one day for the governor of Texas, and that might have been one of his ambitions. I mean, it wasn't impossible to consider that possibility until he shot and killed D.E. Chips in his office. Now, he said it was self-defense, and that was going to be his argument.
Didn't Chips, well, according to Norris and his friends, who were the only witnesses, but didn't they claim that Chips had threatened Norris with his life?
That's what they said. There's no evidence. And he also, he didn't have a gun, although Norris, for years afterwards, was convinced that he had a gun and that somebody stole the gun, the police or whatever. It was a gun that had been there. But he turned, and there was also something in Texas at the time called the hip pocket move, where you could, if you put your hand in your pocket like you're going for a gun, that was enough justification. And that's where the title of the book comes from, Eric. Apparent danger. You know, there's imminent danger, but apparent danger is a different legal doctrine. And that entitles a person, or at least it did, where they apparently felt they were in danger or apparent danger, they would be justified in shooting someone. Whether that was the case in Norris's case, you know, was a matter for trial and is still debated by those who know the story to this day.
Back again after a brief break.
Throughout history, royals across the world were notorious for incest. They married their own relatives in order to consolidate power and keep their blood blue. But they were oblivious to the havoc all this inbreeding was having on the health of their offspring. From Egyptian pharaohs marrying their own sisters to the Habsburgs' notoriously oversized lower jaws. I explore the most shocking incestuous relationships and tragically inbred individuals in royal history. And that's just episode one. On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history. Join me every Tuesday for new episodes of the History Tea Time podcast, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
And we have returned. So what did Mayor Meacham do? How did he handle this?
Oh, he was so devastated. First of all, he paid for all the funeral expenses for his friend. He mourned him. And then he used his political power to ensure that Norris would be coming up before a grand jury, and he did very quickly. He was indicted. But even to sweeten the pot, Mayor Meacham actually out of his own pocket hired special prosecutors to help the prosecutors in Tarrant County, Fort Worth. And so he hired special prosecutors, some of the biggest, most expensive lawyers of the day. And he hired these lawyers to help prosecute the case. He wasn't going to let this guy get away. And Norris was charged with first-degree murder. And that was the only charge. He went for all or nothing at all. First degree murder, which of course implied premeditation. They tried to prove that at the trial. The trial was scheduled to begin in November. This murder took, or the shooting took place in July. And in early November, the trial was scheduled to begin. And they were surprised, the prosecution was surprised, because the defense decided to move to have a change of venue because they felt like Norris couldn't get a fair trial in Fort Worth. And so this was debated for several days. And eventually the judge ruled that the venue could be changed. And the trial was set then for Austin, for Travis County in Austin, Texas, the state capital, for the following January. And all eyes of the country were then on Austin, Texas, as a new governor by the name of Dan Moody was being inaugurated, and the sensational J. Frank Norris murder trial was taking place. Now, this is the 1920s, right? You think of the 1920s of famous trials, Sacco and Vanzetti, Leopold and Loeb. You've dealt with some of these in your excellent podcast that I listen to when I exercise, which is not nearly enough. And of course, you have the Scopes Monkey trial in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee. You had the Clara Hayman trial in 1921. I wrote a book about that, and you did a podcast about that a few years ago with me. And so this was a time of great courtroom trials. The one of those that's forgotten was one of the biggest ones, and that was the Norris trial in January of 1927 in Austin, Texas.
So Norris claimed that he had no idea who Dexter Chips was. How did prosecutors formulate a strategy around first-degree murder when on the surface it didn't appear that there was any real connection between the two men?
Well, they did their best to establish a connection between the two, and that is that Norris actually was aware of this man, knew him by name, knew him by sight. Chips was himself a rather colorful fellow. He lived at the Westbrook Hotel, which is no longer in Fort Worth. It was one of the big hotels during the oil boom, and just a block or two blocks from the church. And he was a person who was estranged for a while from his wife and his son. He liked alcohol, even though it wasn't legal to buy it. And when he drank, he could become rowdy. He was kicked out of one hotel and told never to come back. That was the Hotel Texas, which is a footnote, by the way, is the last place President Kennedy spent the night before he died tragically the next day in Dallas. But Chips was known well to the police, so they tried their best to make the case that Norris did know who he was and knew that he had been threatened and was prepared to counter that if that man should come to his office.
So what kind of defense team was Norris able to hire?
Well, Norris hired some brilliant guys. He hired a lawyer by the name of Moses, and he hired another one by the name of Dayton. And these lawyers were very well. What's interesting is the lawyers that were hired by Meacham to prosecute were better defense lawyers. One of them had been on that Clara Hayman case back in 1921, a wild Bill McLean, they called him. But the lawyers that Norris hired were also known better as prosecutors. And so it made for an interesting turn of events, you know, for the trial. But both sides were represented with the highest powered lawyers you could possibly have at the time, certainly in that part of the country.
So what were some of the highlights of the trial for you?
Well, you had Marvin Simpson was one of Norris's lawyers. Dayton Moses was another one. And, you know, the prosecution had to prove that Norris was doing this premeditated. They had to get the right kind of jury together, spent a lot of time in jury selection. And then when they got the jury together that they wanted, they went to trial, and they really thought that they had him. They brought a witness, a lady that came forward. She was in her 70s. Her name was Parker, and she had supposedly come to see Norris on the day of the shooting about some property. Her husband and her owned some property at some other part of Texas that they wanted to sell, and they thought Norris was looking for some land for a camp for kids. And so they came to see Norris, she did, and she left, and apparently by the timeline, she left the office just about a minute or two before D.E. Chips came into Norris's office. But she remembers the man coming in, and she remembers what the man was agitated. She testified about hearing certain things happen. And the prosecution thought that with this lady testifying, that they pretty much had a slam dunk. And they, after they put this lady on the stand and then she was cross-examined, they basically rested their case. Now, you also have to know this is by up to that time, the largest coverage of national media of a trial up to that time. It's been growing throughout the 20s. Newspapers sending people to these trials, you know, the one in Tennessee with the scopes being a case a year before, year and a half before. But there are people from all over the country filing reports hour by hour, getting out through the UPI, through Associated Press, through the Hearst Syndicate and others, getting information about this trial around the country. And after that prosecution rested, Norris began his defense, and they just tried to take it apart piece by piece and create sympathy for Norris before the crowd, and eventually Norris himself testified.
What was that testimony like?
Well, it was very emotional for him, and you know, whether this was contrived or whether it was how he really felt, he wept a lot, he cried a lot, he regretted that he had to do it, but you know, he insisted it was self-defense. And you can, when you read the newspaper accounts and you read the trial transcripts and you read the coverage, you can see where his argument is beginning to wear down the sentiment. What would seem like, I mean, when you go into this story and you see this unarmed man is shot to death in a pastor's office. He's not armed. He's shot to death. He dies there. Nobody even goes over to help him while he's lying on the floor. This isn't a church. And you think, this is a slam dunk. This guy's going to jail. And by the time you get into the trial and into the testimony, even the lawyers that Meacham, Mayor Meacham had hired, began to realize that they weren't going to win this thing. In fact, when Wild Bill McLean does his summation before the jury, he as much as acknowledges that Norris is gonna win this thing. And so it's sort of an interesting study. You know, I would love, there's a television show on called Bull, which he deals with juries. It's a CBS show on Monday nights. And I just wondered what a professional jury consultant would think of that that trial dynamic in that particular trial, because clearly a lawyer, Norris's lawyers bested the other team. And they put on a tremendous defense and created tremendous sympathy, created reasonable doubt, and they did so effectively.
Do you think prosecutors would have gotten a conviction with a manslaughter charge?
Yes. And that to me is the great pivotal point, that Norris, he eventually was acquitted. We're not giving anything, no spoiler alert here. He eventually was acquitted. But the only charge they brought against him was first-degree murder. And McLean had said, it's that or nothing. They believed they had him. And if there would have been a lesser charge there, manslaughter, for instance, or even second degree, like with the trial that just recently happened up in Minnesota, reckless in disregard of life. But certainly manslaughter. Norris would have gone to jail for at least a period of time. And would have had that conviction hanging over his head. I think it was a clear case of malpractice on the part of the prosecution lawyers. They were blinded by their hatred of this person, whether it was justified in part or in all or not at all. They were blinded by it, and as a result, they did not lawyer quite very well at all.
Through this. Or before this, please correct me if I'm wrong, but Norris saw himself being persecuted the same way Pontius Pilate persecuted Christ, right?
Yeah, Norris was a paranoid person. I mean, that is an armchair psychological statement that I make, but he saw conspiracies everywhere. Everybody was out to get him. It was him against the world, and he thought he was being persecuted. He never did anything wrong, so he wound up landing on his feet. He may have been a sociopath, have sociopathic tendencies, I don't know. But certainly he was a paranoid person. Everybody was out to get him, and that was one of the reasons that he shot Chips in the first place.
So how does Norris handle this? Does he leave the courtroom triumphant after the verdict?
Does. He does. He even wants a parade. They don't do a parade for him, but he's received back in Fort Worth as a hero. He basically, even within weeks, produces a gun in the pulpit and waves it around, you know, don't come mess with me, you know, that kind of thing. He was quite the sensationalist. There is evidence that the shooting itself haunted him for the rest of his life. In a real way, he was never going to be the great leader of fundamentalism, but he created his own movement, a very effective movement. His church continued to grow, and he created a movement of independent churches pulled out of a Southern Baptist convention. He created the movement out of which Jerry Falwell came back in the early 50s, and so. You know, not an insignificant thing. He got involved with politics even more. He got involved with the issue of after the Second World War, the issue of Israel becoming a nation. He even lobbied President Truman on that account, and had correspondence with Truman on that account. So he saw himself as a very important person. He saw himself larger than he really was. He was a tireless and unapologetic self-promoter, but he continued to do that until he died in 1952.
So how is Norris viewed by the Baptist Church today?
Well, the movement called Independent Fundamental Baptists, IFB, they consider him a hero. I mean, you go to their various sites, you can always trace it back to Norris. Norris didn't take anything from anybody. If evil people came his way, he'd shoot them down. I mean, he's a total hero to them. And the DNA of Norris is in that aggressive, independent, fundamental Baptist mindset that is very, very particular. But he's also a subject of interest to a lot of people. I mean, when I wrote Apparent Danger, I found out later that one of the professors at Baylor University was recommending it to his students as a good look at that part of the history. There's a new book that's coming out that parallels J. Frank Norris with his contemporary George W. Truett, who was the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas at the time. Two diametrically different men, but at the same time, giants in the day. They were fierce enemies, I might add, and that's part of what the book, I think, is about. But the point being that he is revered as a hero. And because he was acquitted, that's worn as a badge of honor. So, when that book came out, I was accused of slandering Norris, you know, because I talked about the Klan, because I talked about, you know, the fact that he should have been convicted of manslaughter. But the bottom line is people forget those things. And for people who are of a strict mindset, particularly independent fundamental Baptists, Norris is a legendary hero to them. To the rest of the culture, religious or otherwise, he is one of a long list of people who fell from grace and maybe shouldn't have been as high as he was when he fell in the first place.
As an ordained minister yourself, I assume that you attended seminary school?
Yes, I went to a Bible college in Springfield, Missouri that actually began in the early 50s as a break off of a Norris's organization in Fort Worth. And the president of my college was Norris's assistant in Detroit, but eventually broke with Norris. Norris had a hard time keeping staff loyal to him, frankly, because he was so domineering and so authoritarian. And so, yes, that's my training. You know, I grew up around that. And my training came from that. I went more non-denominational as my career unfolded. I retired in 2019 after 40 years pastoring a non-denominational church in Fairfax, Virginia. But I was part of that. So yeah, that's how I know. I think well poised to write this particular book because I knew the language, I knew the lingo, and I knew the whole story.
Yes, it's very extensively researched.
Well, thank you.
Yes. So you have a website. Would you share that website with
us? Sure. Yeah, people can find me at davidrstokes.com, at davidrstokes.com. And Apparent Dangers there, other books I've written, and I blog there. My newest book is called JFK's Ghost. It's coming out in June. Lions Press is publishing it. It's about the making of Profiles in Courage, that famous book from John F. Kennedy back in the 50s. So, but davidrstokes.com is where they can find out all that stuff.
Well, excellent. Thank you for coming back one more time.
I'm glad to, Eric, and I listen to your podcast. I enjoy it. I mean, you cover stories not only that are fascinating, but you cover them so thoroughly, and I'm a big fan.
Oh, I appreciate that. Again, I have been speaking to David Stokes. He is the author of Apparent Danger, the pastor of America's first megachurch, and the Texas murder trial of the decade in the 1920s. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.